Today at Radio Verulam, we are once again speaking to one of your local representatives. We are speaking to Conservative MP Bim Afolami to get the answers to your questions. And remember, if you've not been lucky enough to get your answers from Bim this time, he'll be back again next month in December, once again, fielding your questions. But of course, since we last talked, Bim, there has been a second lockdown. And I just want to know if you've been keeping well and how much life and work has changed for you during this second lockdown of 2020.
Very good question, because it is very, very difficult. The truth is, Parliament is still functioning. Parliament is still operational. And so I've been in Parliament, 4 days a week. And so in that sense, professionally, not a huge amount has changed. Though we are, just during this month, we haven't been having sort of in-person meetings in Downing Street, for example. But more broadly, of course, like everybody else, I all the things that I like doing on weekends, which don't all involve drinking, going to the pub or hang out with the boys and taking them to rugby at Harpen Rugby Club and all those sorts of things I've missed doing, like so many other people. And in relation to sport, it's one of the reasons why I spoke to several times Oliver Dowden, who's a Hertfordshire MP, who lives, in the area, to try and get outdoor sports allowed. And what we now have is that going forward in all the tiers, outdoor sports are allowed. And I think that's in large part due to not just me, but many other Conservative MPs, campaigning on that issue.
A lot of the news this month has obviously been focused on this second lockdown, but there has been news looking forward to the future, with the government announcing this month the grand plans of a green industrial revolution in this country. There are 10 main points to this that cover a wide area of the economy, but could you talk us through some of these ideas and also how it will affect your local residents and constituency too, Bim?
The difficulty about politics and in government is quite often you make these grand announcements and it's difficult for people to understand what that means locally, what that actually looks like on the ground. So I'm going to try and do that and put it in some context for people in Harpenden and Wheatamstead and Redbourne and Sandridge and indeed St Albans and the surrounding area. The focus is on about climate change, but critically, climate change is not the only aspect to this plan. It is about the environment, the local environment. One key way in which we're doing that is bringing forward the date of banning new petrol and diesel cars, 2030. That means that we are accelerating the provision of electric cars. And what that's going to mean locally is it's going to mean lower emissions in the town centre or indeed the city centre in St Albans. But it's also going to mean, much more electric vehicle infrastructure, charging infrastructure that we're going to have to build. And I'm working with the local council in order to do that. We've also got more funding for cycling infrastructure. This is something that I know is very important to lots of local people. And my job, and one of the things that I'm doing within government, is saying to my colleagues, we can't reserve all this cycling infrastructure for big cities. This needs to go out to more rural areas, in particular, like my constituency, but it's not just my constituency. It needs to go out to areas outside big cities, because we need to allow people who don't live in, Birmingham, Manchester, London, access to really high quality cycling infrastructure. That means roads like the A5183. So for example, going from Redbourne into St Albans, we need that to have to be properly sorted out for cyclists so that they can do it safely. And that's the sort of thing that I'll be working on. Tree planting, afforestation, peatland preservation and rewilding, which is included in the plan to sort of harness Mother Nature's natural technology to capture more carbon. I think we all must do our part. I'm pledging, and this is an announcement for you, I haven't told this to anybody else in public, I am pledging to offset carbon footprint from my office with the help of the Woodland Trust and the parish councils who are helping me identify sites for native trees in public areas. And the first round of planting of these trees is going to start in March. So I am, you know, trying to do this in my work, all the carbon footprint from my office with the help of those organizations. And so that's very exciting. So this is the sort of thing that the 10-point environment plan delivers.
And kind of bring it again to the discussions in your local constituency. You've described your own personal plan there, but in the Commons as well, you've been debating on issues about it. In the debate on the producer responsibility obligations, you agreed with the bill's intention to shift the costs to producers, but that you also need to get recycling plants and places to process the waste, but in the right places. Will this be something that you spearhead in Harpenden as a way to help Britain's green revolution come home to your local constituents?
So the way I like to explain this is in a very commonsensical way. If you are an individual, or more usually a business, that produces a lot of waste, or any waste, it should be up to you, and it should be on your cost, as much as we can, for you to deal with that waste and deal with it in a way that does not have any damage to the environment. I think that's a good principle to start from. The bill helps us do that. What does that mean locally? It means we need to work out within Hertfordshire where the right places are for more recycling plants. We don't have enough. We don't have enough places to process this waste. And therefore, what happens is the waste ends up being taken much further away, or often abroad, and therefore incurring all sorts of carbon footprint as we do that. So we need to reasonably locally be able to find the right places to have more recycling so that we can increase our recycling rates in this area. But more importantly, we need to move towards a nature of how we use materials and use waste so that less stuff is wasted. It's a more, what people describe as a more circular economy. We should be recycling much more. Organizations like Plastic Free Harpenden, Sustainable St Albans, you know, and there are others are leading the charge at local level. But I think that what the Environment Bill, which I'm on the Bill Committee, what it does is it helps us move towards that more circular economy, so we can not waste as much of the goods or products that we make.
And bring it back to the economy. We've seen the second lockdown go nationwide. And I've got two questions on this, because first of all, you know, at the start of last month, the idea of the circuit breaker was rejected. So can this be considered a U-turn? And also, on top of this, what changes will we see now in the tier system that is different from the old one to stop another lockdown from happening, Bim?
So I was always very unhappy with the idea of a lockdown. I think we, the people that seemed to desire lockdowns with glee, need to realize the significant health and economic impacts of it. But reluctantly, you know, I was persuaded by, you know, in discussions with the Prime Minister, the Health Secretary, and others in government, that once they had seen the data that they had seen, that meant that the health service wouldn't be able to cope within a matter of weeks, they were forced to do what, you know, what we had to do, which was to have a month long lockdown. Now, what the Prime Minister has announced is that we're moving back to the tiered system, though it's an adapted one. How will that tiered system be different? In effect, it is designed to make sure that we reduce the transmission further of the disease, whilst allowing things that keep the economy moving and keep people's health going, in particular their mental well-being, if we think of outdoor sports and exercise. You know, we've got to, and so under all the tiers, people will be able to do that. Under all the tiers, people will be able to do swimming in swimming pools, because actually there is no evidence of COVID transmission at all in that instance. So what we're trying to do is tighten things in relation to household mixing and contact. And look, that's very difficult. But it does have to be done for a temporary period of time whilst the vaccine, we get it out there and get things moving on that front as well with mass testing, but also keep the things that we know with the economy, whether it be the hospitality sector, allowing them to close at 11 p.m. rather than 10 p.m., and also with people's mental and physical health, keep those things going. I think that that's the right mix. In this area, you know, my constituency in particular, and I don't think it's hugely dissimilar for St. Albans, has the lowest rate within Hertfordshire. I don't believe that, you know, I think that we should be put onto tier one, and I'll be advocating for that very, very strongly within government.
And let's bring it on to another, as some have described, a potential U-turn in the idea that the government initially opposed a food package deal, describing that, as you did on Radio Verulam, that a booster to universal credit was the best way to solve issues. But now a £396 million deal has been agreed that will see most vulnerable get bills and food paid for until March 2021. What was the reasoning behind this change in view, Bim?
Well, it wasn't a change in view insofar as what we haven't done is done what the Labour opposition proposed. And what they proposed, to be clear, was that in effect, schools and school and free school meal vouchers should be used in the holidays at times. That is not what we've done, the reasons that we documented. What we've decided to do, which by the way, is costing more money than that would have cost. So this wasn't done for financial reasons. This isn't done to balance the books per se. This is actually costing more money than what Labour proposed. Is we are saying we are making sure that local councils and through them also food distribution charities and other voluntary groups are going to be able to identify and make sure we get food to all vulnerable children. That are not just children at school, it includes preschool children as well, because the free school meals sort of argument that was only relating to kids who are at school. So these are really vulnerable families, whether they have children of school age or preschool age, and we're making sure that it gets to absolutely every one of them, in addition to making sure they have more money getting through this very difficult time. I think that's the right way of doing this. It's my frustration that we weren't able to communicate very effectively during the whole free school meals PR sort of debacle. But that's politics, and I'm not complaining about that. I'm just saying that next time you have to do a much better job and explain to people what we're doing.
Another issue that a lot of people have wanted an explanation on is your backing of Priti Patel this month. Even with the admission and the apology that she did something wrong, her behaviour has been said to be in breach of ministerial code, even if it was unintentionally. But there is no evidence that she was aware of the impact of her behaviour and no feedback was given at the time. Across the country, this has reminded people of the Dominic Cummings affair, where it seems those with close links to the government are not held to the same rules as others. Is this a fair summarisation, Bim?
Unsurprisingly, I don't think that's fair. The issue is this. In relation to the ministerial code, there is one adjudicator of the ministerial code, and that is the Prime Minister. That has always been the case. So that's the first thing. In relation to Priti Patel, what I said in public, and I stand by every word of it now, is that as a colleague, and by the way, the number of colleagues from all wings of the Conservative Party who came out in support of her is quite striking, and it is not normal for that to happen. Just by showing everybody just how respected she is throughout the whole of Parliament. What I said about Priti was, she's been a kind colleague, when I was brand new, she's been around a lot longer in the House of Commons than I have been. She's been a kind colleague, very easy to deal with, and she's been a very effective Home Secretary. And it's frankly up to the Prime Minister to judge whether he regards that she broke the ministerial code or not. The Prime Minister's accepted her explanation. In relation to whether people saying, the Prime Minister shouldn't have accepted her explanation. Well, the Prime Minister looked at the evidence and that was the decision he took. I know that, I support her in the job that she's doing. She's doing a very difficult job. And actually, if you consider the work she's been doing in terms of increasing the number of police officers that are going to be on our streets, this is something that I know in Harpenden people frequently talk to me about and frequently ask me about. Because particularly last year when, you know, I was out and about a bit more, you know, I think she's doing a good job. But, you know, do I think therefore that all actions are okay as long as someone's doing a good job? Of course not. And she's already said that, you know, inadvertently she may have communicated in ways that people didn't like. I think that, you know, I take her word. She's doing a very, very tough job. These jobs at the top end of politics are incredibly intense. I find it a little difficult to believe when you've got some of the grandest permanent secretaries in Whitehall. So Philip Rutnam, been around for 35 years, who now claims that he was bullied by the Home Secretary. I'm not sure I really buy that. I think there was quite a lot of difficulty going on in that department. It's the same department where Amber Rudd, when she was Home Secretary, was deliberately given false information by senior civil servants, and as a result had to resign. And actually the inquiry afterwards found out that actually she was deliberately given poor, wrong information by those civil servants that she then repeated. And this same department didn't get rid of those civil servants, it just transferred them to other jobs. So I think there have been a lot of problems in that department over the years. I think that what Priti did was she went in to say, look, I've got to sort this out. And maybe in doing that, you know, her energy and zeal to do so may have been misinterpreted, but, you know, I support her in the work she's doing.
So let's move on to my last question before we go into the community questions. You were proudly the first father in parliamentary history to vote by proxy whilst on paternity leave. You know, that is quite a historic event. But the COVID situation has meant that many MPs had not been able to fully participate for months. But with this week, Jacob Rees-Mogg has explained that I've been urgently exploring how we can support additional virtual participation in the Commons despite capacity constraints, and hope to bring forward this motion soon. But with such urgency, why has the Conservative government taken so long to be able to bring about systems to safeguard vulnerable MPs and their families to participate safely?
Well, we have, and the House authorities, it's worth saying that matters for the House are matters for the House. They're not, you know, the House votes on these things, not the government. The government doesn't decide them. The House of Commons votes for them. We have virtual participation in debates, rather in questions, in statements, as the Prime Minister's shown with his sort of house arrest over the last, you know, 10 days or so. So we've already got quite a lot of virtual participation, and the House authorities should be congratulated on their work. All the, effectively, the debate now is around debates on whether people who are not in the Commons should be able to participate in debates. The difficulty is debates by their nature can only work when people are physically present. Debates are not just people reading out prepared speeches. They are people interacting with the dispatch box, with the minister, with the shadow minister. It's very, very difficult to do that virtually. And so, look, the leader of the House, Jacob, is doing his best, and I look forward to seeing what he's come up with, but it is not an easy problem to solve. For people who want, of course, voting has been sorted out. There is nobody who is not able to vote because they are sort of, for health reasons, away from Parliament. So voting is entirely possible and has been all throughout the pandemic, as has virtual participation in questions and statements.
But this relates to the Tracy Crouch kind of incident here. You know, there was the debate on breast cancer and she wasn't able to be involved. Is that not a little bit unfair? Will that be sorted out soon, Bim?
Well, I mean, I know that this, it relates to the same point. It's around debates, and there are capacity difficulties, as the leader has said, with including people virtually in debates when you have people who are there in the chamber contributing in a real-time way. This is something, by the way, that there is no legislature in the world that is able to do. There is no evidence from anywhere else that has done it. And, you know, the leader is doing his best.
Okay, so we can bring it into the community questions here. And as always, it's a busy one, Bim. Radio Verulam is here to help the community, but there's always lots sent in for you to answer. Now, we've had quite a lot of people message about your expenses claims, and some have cited that you claimed £8,300 in expenses, whereas Daisy Cooper has only claimed £1,500 for the period of 2020 to 21. One listener asked, does this extra 6-minute train journey really cost that much? Could you give an explanation into how MPs' expenses work?
Yeah, so the first thing is that my constituency, MPs' expenses rather, works, first of all, depending on which constituency. So you either have a London constituency and what's regarded as an outer London constituency, or you have the rest. I am neither a London MP, nor am I regarded as an outer London MP. St Albans is regarded as an outer London constituency. So actually, the nature of the things that they can effectively, in relation to their expenses, is very different. And part of that is because my constituency is quite rural and quite big. St Albans is quite small in physical size and in number of electors. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that what expenses really relate to are office expenses. They're not expenses like me going out for lunch or dinner, or any MP going out for lunch or dinner or whatever. So it's really, and I haven't examined Daisy Cooper's expenses, and you know, Lib Dem activists are doing their best, but it's really about my staff, the constituency office, paper, printers, computers, travel. One thing also on being the PPS, the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, and before that to the Secretary of State for International Trade, is quite often your responsibilities are greater than an opposition backbench MP that Daisy Cooper is. So also you are also doing more in terms of traveling across the country and various other things which may impact on travel expenses, though I've no idea what hers are. So that's really how it all works.
Something that is related to expenses now, Bim. There's been quite a few questions this month from listeners about the announced £16.5 billion increase in defence spending over the next 4 years. But the government has warned about austerity or tax rises post-COVID to obviously pay for these huge, costly situations. But some people have messaged in asking, does this not give a mixed message that money is there to be spent on things that the government wants, but not on other things, that maybe is not wanted? Can you explain this kind of huge government spending there, Bim?
Well, if the question is, can money be spent on everything all the time, at whatever level, the answer is no. So of course, people are right if the charge is, well, the government's making a political decision around what to spend money on more and what to spend money less. Well, of course that's true. And the political decision we've made is one that I'm very comfortable with, which is making sure that our defence, our armed forces remain some of the best in the world. And critically, as a large part of the spending for the armed forces, that money is also helping to feed through into the British economy, because it goes into making tanks and ships and aircraft carriers and producing weapons, a large number of which are going to happen within the United Kingdom. So it's not just helping the armed forces, it's also helping thousands of jobs across the country. And, you know, the way I think about this is the Conservative Party and the government, you know, we are the party, you know, of the nation. We are the party of the armed forces, the NHS, national institutions, making sure we strengthen them, making sure they're strong. NHS, the armed forces, the monarchy, that we are a party that represents those things and absolutely has to stand up for them. In relation to the point you made around austerity or tax rises, whatever, look, there is no doubt that you have to have spending restraint, because if you don't have spending restraint, even a 1% rise in interest rates that the government pays on its debt that it goes out to the market. When government wants to borrow money, it has to go to the international markets and say, who wants to lend the government money? The interest rate for that at the moment is low, but it won't be low forever. And a 1% rise in the interest rate the government would pay would lead to about £20 billion more a year in what the government has to pay simply in debt interest. Now, £20 billion is about, it's probably two-thirds, you know, the defence budget, just in 1 year. So the reason why I make that point is you do need to have spending restraint. And for those people who are listening who think, no, what we can do is just spend money, whatever, I'm afraid you can't do that. And what the government now has, admittedly, a very, very tricky, difficult job. And the Chancellor, in fact, I was talking to the Chancellor about this over the weekend, is how we now bring down spending, but at the same time, protect and strengthen our key public services at the same time as not taxing people and taxing business to a point where the economy doesn't grow. So this is not an easy calculation and it has to be worked out, you know, over the coming months and years.
Chris is a local personal trainer, and I have to say he sent me a very lengthy email, you know, expressing his concern about the situation with gyms. But to kind of summarise his question, it was about the new rules that the government seemed to be introducing that gyms are going to stay open. His concern was previously they were promised to stay open, but does that mean now in all the tier systems, no matter what, gyms are going to stay open? He says, as a PT, he's been undertaking a huge amount of work to clean the gym, to stop COVID, and also to have a huge impact on people's mental health. He said that there's lots of data suggest that gyms are safe. Is this a reassurance that you can give to people who want to go to the gym, but also people who rely on gyms for business across, you know, Hertfordshire, Harpenden, and across the country, Bim?
Yes. I can give that assurance. And frankly, as I said about outdoor sports, you know, it's my view that we should make sure that people can do physical exercise. I think it's absolutely key. And, you know, gyms are a key part of that. And it's my understanding that in all the tiers, gyms will be able to remain open.
And moving on to an interesting question, maybe linked to the US election here, but Sally has cited that in Oregon, USA, the state has now decriminalized all drugs. Many of the states across the USA have legalized the use of cannabis. Will there be a change in the UK's drug policy that Sally says doesn't seem to be working and also seems to be hypocritical when, as the UN has reported, the UK is the world's largest producer of legal cannabis?
Well, I don't think it's hypocritical to allow people for medical reasons in exceptional circumstances to be able to use cannabis if it's deemed that it will help them. I think there's quite a big difference between that and people smoking cannabis behind the bike sheds, frankly. So I don't think it's hypocritical. But I am, you know, surprise, surprise, I'm a Conservative MP. I'm pretty small-c Conservative about this subject. I think that legalising drugs is a bad idea. I think that what you will end up doing is you will end up effectively promoting increased amounts of drug use. You also end up with a slippery slope of once you legalize one drug, people will say, well, what about another one? What about another one? And what about another one? However, I do think for medical reasons, to the extent that it can really help somebody just survive medically with something like, you know, multiple sclerosis, for example. You know, I support that, and we were the first government to do that. But, you know, I'm not somebody that now thinks that we should have a free-for-all for dope, I'm afraid.
Joy has moved it on to another issue that she feels may affect local constituency businesses, and this is the new HFSS rules. So that's in terms of high in fats, sugars and salts, and it's the advertising to do with it. She says that it seems like there'll be an added unnecessary bureaucracy and problems for businesses who want to advertise their products. Do you think that this will surely affect small business food producers here in Harpenden and other local areas hardest, especially in regards to the online ban?
I'm afraid I had no idea about these regulations. So look, Joy should email me. I'm very, very happy to talk to her about it because I really didn't know this was happening. Maybe I should have, but I really want to talk to her about it. From what she said and what you've just said, I mean, I think that we need to be reducing bureaucracy, not increasing it. So, you know, I want to talk to Joy about this and I'll see what I can do.
Excellent. Well, I will hand over if Joy obviously consents to this. Again, this is Radio Verulam seeing, you know, politics in action by getting answers to people's questions here. Now, Michael has moved it on, and it's quite a contentious subject, this, but he explains his beliefs. You know, once again, these are what listeners are asking, so it's not our opinions on this. The government seems to be hiding things when it comes to spending, and the word cronyism is being used to describe what appears to be unfair practices. Indeed, it may have been a continued breach of the UK law. The Good Law Project, along with many MPs, have called for this disclosure on over £4 billion worth of contracts with private firms. Could you give any kind of insight into what Michael has highlighted there, Bim?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to say is that when I first was in Parliament, I sat on something called the Public Accounts Committee, which is really the public spending watchdog. It looks at all areas of government spending, and it's backed up by who I think are the smartest civil servants in Whitehall, the National Audit Office. The National Audit Office has recently done a report on various procurement practices that I think Mike was referring to. And I've read the report, contrary to various lots of other people. I don't know if Michael's read it or not. But I've read it, and I've actually, you know, been in correspondence with some of the people who've put together the report. And I can say to you that, first of all, the government has not hidden anything in relation to any of these contracts. They have all been opened for the National Audit Office to look at. Secondly, of course, some contracts that were entered into did not deliver what the contract was meant to deliver, because we're in the middle of a pandemic. And in particular around PPE, think back, just remember the difficulties we had around PPE. You know, every single second people were saying, why can't we get PPE to health workers? Why can't we get PPE to this group? Why can't we get PPE to that group? The reason why we had the difficulties was there was a worldwide shortage. Therefore, there were lots of companies then either produce the PPE or procure it from somewhere abroad that we had to pay for. And if you're having to pay for things in a disaster situation like that, which is what we're in, it often costs you quite a lot of money. And that is just the unavoidable reality of it. There is nothing improper that has occurred. And the National Audit Office did not find one contract where they said there was anything corrupt or improper in relation to it. They did not find one. And when he talks about usage of the word cronyism, it generally tends to be opposition party MPs who use the word, or journalists. Now, I'm not saying they should be banned from using the word. I'm just making the point that people have got to realize the motivations behind the people using this, rather than, you know, they've got to look at the motivations. And actually, if they really are concerned, go and read the National Audit Office report, and they will see that it is not what the newspaper headlines are alleging it is.
And just two quick questions here to summarize, Bin, because, you know, as always, we realize that you're limited in time. Mary has asked, I think, an important question that a lot of people are mulling over. And she said, will you be getting the COVID vaccine? And I suppose...
Yes, yes, I'm in favour of it. I'm anti-vax. I think this is ridiculous and absurd. And I think everybody should be getting it as fast and as fast as humanly possible.
And I suppose you're anti the fake news around anti-vaccination as well.
I'm anti-fake news. I'm anti-vax. But there's a serious point to this, which is we're just going to have to work out how in a democracy we're going to operate with the sheer number of charlatans around just peddling nonsense online. And I'm afraid quite a lot of people end up believing them. And we can't carry on like this. I think that the social media companies, Facebook, Twitter, and the rest of them, we need to be a lot tougher on them. In my view, we need to start making them responsible, like any newspaper, responsible for what they print. And they've got some of the smartest people in the world working for them in terms of IT and technology. They can remove offensive content. They can remove inaccurate content when they want to. I think we need to start legislating and be much tougher with them, because it's one thing sort of, you know, in terms of political debate. It's another thing when it comes to this sort of anti-vax nonsense, because this is about people's lives. So, you know, my tolerance for this is quite low, to be honest. And I think we need to be much tougher on the social media companies to stop these charlatans from getting any traction.
And just to finish on maybe a high point here, Bim, and I've asked the other MPs in this, so next month when we talk in December, we can review an update on your role. But it's coming up to Christmas. What is your role in the Afolabi household? Do you undertake the cooking, or are there other kind of uses for your skills in the household?
Well, this is a very, very good question because normally last year was the first year where we hosted Christmas to both sides of the family. So we hosted everybody last year. I'm not sure, as at the time we're speaking, we haven't come out with the rules on what Christmas, what's going to be allowed at Christmas. It's my understanding that it may be sort of there will be households able to join up, but not maybe as many as we normally have. With that in mind, what I tend to do is I tend to be sort of entertainer in chief of all children because I'm really, really good at telling stories. And I will often do that. And we'll also play with various toys in the garden. And we've got sort of a den and various things in the garden and climbing frame, various things. So I will generally take the children out, largely because I don't want them running around my house and going to my study or doing things that I don't want inside my house. So basically, my job is to be in charge of children. And once I've finished running around with them outside, is inevitably putting the telly on, which then creates a row between my wife, who's saying, oh, the children shouldn't be watching telly, and me saying, well, they wanted to. And then we have lunch. So that's normally how it goes.
Well, it sounds like a fun day at the Afolabi household. And just as always, I have to thank you for your time today, Bim, and a reassurance that you will be back again next month, just
No
before
problem.
Christmas.
Thanks for your time.